Welcome to the Portland Christian Center podcast. Today, Pastor Ray continues our LOL series with part two. Here's Pastor Ray.
Out of this amazing little letter, only four chapters long, the book of Philippians, it's not so much a doctrinal letter as it is just an encouragement from the heart of Paul, very personal, very sensitive, very intimate letter. We have begun this new series. We started it 2 weeks ago, took a break last week for Mother's Day, and Linda Noah spoke, did a great job last Sunday. We pick it back up today. The series is called Laugh Out Loud. Laugh Out Loud. And in this series, as we listen to Paul, we're going to learn how to kiss our troubles goodbye and say hello to continuous, contagious, outrageous joy. Doesn't that sound good, especially in this day and age when it's just kind of dark and dreary out there emotionally and culturally, that we can live in the joy of the Lord? And in chapter 4, verse 4, kind of one of the theme verses of the book of Philippians, chapter 4, verse 4, Paul actually, he doesn't tell us this, he doesn't say this, but he actually orders us into joy. It's like he's saying, you will rejoice whether you like it or not. You're going to be joyful. Chapter 4, verse 4 says this, read it with me, rejoice in the Lord always. I will say it again, rejoice. It's a command. Rejoice in the Lord always. I will say it again, rejoice. Now, why is it a command? Why does Paul feel the need to power up on us and order us to be joyful? You know, I mean, and can you command joy? You know, what's the deal with that? What's up with that? Why commanded to joy? Well, because joy is the fingerprint that God leaves behind in your life. Joy is I would argue, the best evidence that God has been active in you. This past weekend, our grandkids brought their parents down to our house. We saw the parents a little bit, but we really saw the grandkids a lot. They're just awesome little boys. And Linda has a lot of glass in our house, a glass dining room, kitchen table, glass end tables, coffee tables. We have these two beautiful glass doors that go out onto our patio. And you can tell when our grandkids have been there. You know what I'm talking about, grandparents and parents? There are fingerprints everywhere. If you came to our house, you would say either they never cleaned their house or their grandkids have been here. They leave evidence that they've been here. What is the evidence that God is in your life, has been in your life, is at work in your life? The fingerprint is joy. Moreover, joy is what attracts a watching world to your Jesus. I think as much as anything else, better than anything else, the world is not attracted to your doctrine. They're not impressed by the church that you go to. They don't care about the spiritual language that they use. They are attracted to your joy because they just can't figure that out. That doesn't make sense to them. It makes you, the joy of the Lord makes you living proof of a loving God to a lost world. That's why we ought to be joyful. Furthermore, joy is the byproduct. It's the natural byproduct of the Spirit-filled life. But the fruit of the Spirit is joy. It's just naturally there, or it should be. It should be. Joy is the fruit juice that should leak when you're poked. When your life gets squeezed, you know what ought to come out? Not complaining, not bitterness, but joy. And then this is the most important reason why Paul commands joy. It's God's will. Frankly, your joy is God's will. Paul, in a different part of the New Testament, 1 Thessalonians 5, 16 through 18 says this, rejoice always, for this is God's will for you. That's why he says, rejoice in the Lord. Again, I tell you, rejoice. That's why it's a command. It is God's will for you. Now, how is that even possible? How is that even possible? Given all of the joy killers that we experience in life, early and often. Not only in life, but perhaps we experience joy killers weekly, daily, if not hourly. Things that rob our joy. You have already experienced some of those today, probably already. You came into the parking lot and your spot wasn't available. And you actually had to walk up the hill to get to the church. Those teenagers parked close to the church and you had to park way down there. It robbed you of your joy. You came in and somebody was sitting in your seat. And you were tempted to lose your joy. Am I right? Did you experience any joy killers? If not today, have you experienced joy killers this week? Events? that depleted your joy, news that robbed you of your joy, people that were killjoys in your life. Anyone sitting next to a killjoy right now, don't look. Whatever you do, don't look at them. Just blink twice and I'll know what you're talking about, right? Yeah, oh yeah, a lot of you. So how do you, given all of these joy killers, killjoys in our lives, how do we ward off the incessant barrage of them so that we can do what Paul has commanded, so that we can rejoice in the Lord always? Well, to find out, let's pick back up where we left off 2 weeks ago in Philippians chapter 1, where James started, Philippians chapter 1 and verse 6. And by the way, this is going to be one of those verses that you ought to commit to memory. Philippians per square inch has more of these memorable verses than any other book in the Bible, I think. It is just replete with these soundbite verses that I'm going to encourage you to memorize from time to time. And this is one of them. This is a great verse. It says this, being confident. Everyone say confident. I hate it when pastors make people do that. So I'll try not to do that. So being confident, say confident. I'm kidding. Being confident of this. Being confident of this, that he who began a good work in you will carry it on to completion. Carry it on, continuous. Carry it on to completion until the day of Christ Jesus. Now, I want to say something very, very important as it relates to joy, to your joy. Confidence that God is at work and that he will complete his work is the very underpinning of joy. Listen, this is the foundation. This is what joy rests upon. It leans upon. It's built upon. This is the, if you will, the linchpin of joy in your life. That you are confident that God is at work, and you are just as confident that he will take that work on to completion until the day of Jesus Christ. And that one day you will stand before God complete, without fault, and he will present you before his glorious throne without fault and with great joy himself. Jude 1, verse 23, talks about that, that God is able to bring to completion what he has started, and he will. That is the underpinning of joy. Being confident in that comes by exerting trust. It doesn't just happen naturally. You have to exert trust in that. And as you exert trust in that, that confidence is built. Well, how do you exert trust? You exert trust by doing two things, by practicing the presence of God. We've talked about that a lot from the pulpit here. It was Brother Lawrence that came up with that rule for the order of monks that he served. He was a kitchen worker. He was a cook and a dishwasher. And in this order, he began to do what came to be called practicing the presence of God. That was, he began to invite Jesus into the everyday ordinary moments of his world, of his life, of his job. As he was washing dishes, he would say, Jesus, be a part of this with me. And everything that he did, he would invite Jesus to be a part of that. That was called practicing the presence of God. And this lowly cook and bottle washer became head of the monastery, and his order became famous in the Catholic world. Practicing the presence of God. That's one. You got to practice the presence. Invite Jesus into the ordinary moments, the daily moments, the mundane moments of your life. Just invite him to be a part of that. Practice the presence of God. And when you do that, proclaim his control over each detail of your life. Invite him in and say, Jesus, you're in control. Help me with this. Bring this to completion. God, you're sovereign, and so I'm trusting you to do this. That's how you do it. You exert trust by practicing God's presence and by proclaiming his control over every detail of your life. Now listen, if you believe that God is in control and he will bring it to completion, then nothing, absolutely nothing, can steal your joy. And everything, absolutely everything, can be embraced as being to your advantage. Everything that happens, God's in control. Everything that happens, God will use to bring about his will for you. It's to your spiritual advantage. And so, therefore, like Joseph in Genesis chapter 50, verse 20. You can declare over hurtful people, you meant it for evil, God made it for good. Anyone that tries to rob your joy, you know, you can say, what you meant for evil, God has turned for good for his purposes. And like Paul, who did this in Romans 8:28, that famous verse, all things work together, you can declare to frustrating events and frustrating news and even of frustrating people, you work for me now. All things work together for my good. Now, what if we did that? What if you practiced that every day this week? What if you said to the stuff that you don't like, that comes your way, the uninvited troubles that intrude as guests into your life, what if every time you said of them, you work for me now? Imagine the perspective change that would come. You imagine how that would free you to flow in the sovereignty of God who is working those things out for your good and to retain your joy. You work for me now. And you may not like what happens, but you know that God hijacks all of your hurts to bring about his plan in your life for his glory. He will repurpose. He will co-opt everything, good and bad, and he does, to complete his good work in you. Now, that wasn't just theology for Paul. It wasn't just theory to Paul, but it was his reality. I want you to see what he says in verse 7. He says, for whether I am in chains, hang on to that word, chains, we're going to talk about that. Whether I'm in chains, which he was, by the way, he was writing, we're going to talk about this over and over again in this series and today in this sermon, he was in prison. This is called a prison epistle. He wrote several letters from jail. For whether I am in chains or defending and confirming the gospel, all of you share God in God's grace with me. Now, what Paul is referring to here is he's expressing joy that from back in verse 4, chapter 1, verse 4, he's expressing his joy that the Philippians were sharing with him in God's grace. He's overjoyed by that. Now, it's interesting, and I think quite significant, purposeful, that both grace and joy, this is a letter of joy, but he's talking about God's grace, grace and joy are the exact same word in the Greek, charis. We get the word charismatic or charisma from that. That's purposeful because both grace and joy are from God. Grace is a gift of God, right? We don't earn it. We don't deserve it. He gives it. We simply receive it by faith. And so is joy. Joy is a gift from God as well. So grace and joy are both rooted in God. Now listen, if you are in God, guess what? They are deeply, inextricably rooted in you as well. Or at least they should be. And that's why grace and its byproduct, joy, aren't subject to the changing weather of circumstances. If your joy goes up and down based on your circumstances, then you need to get back and get rooted in a good theology. They're not subject to the changing weather of human events. And that's why Paul is still praising in prison. You know, when he writes this letter, when he prays the prayers that we see throughout Philippians, he is doing this from prison, for crying out loud. Even in jail, his chains couldn't handcuff the joy of God's grace in his life. He was free to just rejoice in the Lord always. Verses 9 and 11, he's going to come back to this idea of being in chains and what that's enabled him to do. But before he does that, he kind of inserts a prayer here. He's so full of joy for the Philippians that he begins to pray for them. And it's a wonderful prayer, verses 9 through 11. And this is my prayer, that your love may abound more and more in knowledge and in depth of insight, so you may be able to discern what is best and may be pure and blameless until the day of Christ, filled with the fruit of righteousness that comes through Jesus Christ to the glory and the praise of God. Again, I've said it already, but don't forget, Paul's praying this, writing this prayer, dictating this prayer from prison, going on 4 years now. And he's still praying these kinds of uplifting prayers. Now, I don't know about you. I'm probably not nearly as spiritual as you are. But if I were going on 4 hours in a jail, I probably would be praying, God, I'm too important to you to be sitting here. You got to get me out of here. But Paul's not praying that way. He's not praying for himself. He's not praying, God, get me out of here. Remember, he doesn't base his joy on circumstances. So rather than praying for his own deliverance, he's praying for their discipleship. Namely, he's praying for their love, which is the highest fruit of discipleship. He's praying for their love, that their love will be a growing love, a knowing love, and a showing love. Let me explain by what I mean by that. A growing love. That their love will be an ever-increasing love. They will have an ever-expanding capacity to love. Now listen, this kind of love that Paul is talking about never arrives at the train station. It is always on the journey. It is always growing and growing and growing. Getting to new places and it grows, goes further and it grows. For love, biblical love, the journey is the destination. And if you have a love that has arrived, you don't have this kind of love. If your love is not growing, if it's not great, if you don't have a greater capacity to love today than you did yesterday and tomorrow than you did today, then this is not, you don't have the kind of love that Paul is praying for. And I hope that you would change your orientation toward that and begin to pray as Paul does, God, expand my capacity to love. It's also a knowing love. That means it's rooted in biblical truth. More than being rooted in human emotion, it's rooted in biblical truth. I think that's the mistake that we make with love. We often tie it to human feelings, to our emotions, to our feelings. Nothing wrong with that. That's a part of love, but it's only a small part of what agape love, God's love is. God's love is rooted in unchanging biblical truth. It's rooted in God himself who does not change. It's a growing love, it's a knowing love, and it's a showing love. That refers to the application of biblical knowledge precisely and consistently in everyday life. It's not a theory, it's a verb in action. It's interesting, the Greek word for discern that we read there is the word ascetic. Ascetic. Now, ascetic means something that is a beautiful truth that is displayed in real life. And that's what he's talking about with this love, that it is a beautiful biblical truth that is unchanging. But it's really not beautiful, and it's really not truth until it's worked out in the real world, the nitty-gritty daily reality of your life, a growing, knowing, showing love. By the way, that is a higher way to pray. This prayer here, you may just want to adopt it in your prayer for others and for yourself. This is a higher way to pray for people and for yourself. Not, God, get me out of here. Have you prayed that? God, change this? I would encourage you to stop praying that at least right out of the gates. Maybe later on you can, but stop praying, God, change this, and start praying, God, use this. God, use this to change me. God, use this to conform me. God, use this to glorify yourself in me. Not, God, get me out of here, but as Paul prayed, God, use this for my purity, verse 10, the fruit of righteousness, for your praise, verse 11, for the praise and glory of God. That unceasing passion for the glory of God is another recipe for joy. Not only trust in the work of God, the sovereign work of God and its completion, that's one recipe for joy. Here's the other one. Is that we have this interior, unceasing dedication, passion for the glory of God alone. Paul has discovered that recipe. That's why he prays in verse 12. Look at that. Verse 12, now I want you to know that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. Underscore the word advance there, and if your Bible's open or in your notes, advance. What has happened to me, the chains, have served actually to advance the gospel. Now we need to understand that Paul's passion was to preach the gospel in Rome. We see that in the book of Acts, back in 19, verse 21. He says, I got to get to Rome. I got to preach in Rome. We see that in Romans chapter 1, verse 15. Right before Paul says the famous verse, I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it's the power of God for the salvation of everyone, Jews and Gentiles. Before he says that, he says, I must go to Rome. I've got to preach the gospel in Rome. Because Paul knew that his greatest impact would be there at the center of the Roman Empire in the city of Rome, where potentially millions of people would come through and they could hear the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's true, all roads lead to Rome. The Roman Empire was known for the system of roads and highways and the network of byways that it created, but all of those ended and directed and went to Rome. All roads lead to Rome. And that's why Paul strategically wanted to get there, because he knew that those who heard the message and believed would then radiate out from Rome to the ends of the earth with the gospel. Paul's strategy was to go to Rome as a preacher, but he ended up there as a prisoner. He wanted to be a preacher. He ended up as a prisoner, but he didn't quit preaching. Now, that would have been discouraging for most people. Hey, God, what's going on? You know, I came here to be a preacher. I'm a prisoner? What's going on? But not Paul. He was actually energized by this turn of events. He thought, God must be at work here. Now, here's why he thought that way. Again, look at the word advance. It's the Greek word prokope or prokope. And if it sounds familiar, it's because we get our word progress from it. Or as my Canadian friends, progress. It's the word progress. This has served to progress the gospel and my calling to bring the gospel to the ends of the earth. In its verb form, it meant a pioneer advance. A pioneer advance. It was a military term in Paul's day that he chose. He chose this specifically, a military term that referred to the army engineers who would go in advance of the troops into an uncharted, unconquered territory, and they would open up the way. The engineers would arrive first because it was impenetrable. Soldiers couldn't get in there. And so they would go to work. They would cut down trees. They would clear a path. They would build a bridge. They would do whatever it took to then give the army access to this territory that they had been ordered to take, that they had been ordered to conquer. Without the army engineers, without the pioneer advance, the army was stuck. Very, very important term, very important role that these engineers played. So Paul chose that term precisely because he saw his imprisonment not as a detour, but as a doorway. Now that's something that you ought to write down in your notes, because that's true for you as well. Paul saw this not as a detour, but as a doorway. It was a pioneer advance into an uncharted territory that otherwise would have remained closed. If Paul wasn't sent to prison, there were some things that wouldn't have happened that God wanted to happen. Let me just say this to you. Do you realize that every detour in your life is really a door to a new opportunity to glorify God that you would have otherwise missed? Every detour is a doorway into something that wouldn't have opened up to you or for you if you hadn't have gone through that experience. You know that God specializes in detours? You realize that? Just read the Bible a little bit. God's always detouring people into new doorways of opportunity and service for him. For Joseph, it was jail. For Moses, it was a demotion. I mean, for 40 years, he went from prince of Egypt to lowly shepherd on the backside of the Sinai Desert. It was a demotion for Moses. For David, pint-sized David, it was a giant-sized Goliath by which he made his bones of leadership to be the next king of Israel. For Daniel, we're going to hear this tonight, for Daniel, it was a den. God specializes in detours. God specializes in detours. So what is the detour in your life? Are you being detoured right now? A health crisis? A financial crisis, a job crisis, a family crisis, a relational crisis. What is the detour in your life? Listen, it's a doorway. It's a doorway that God has graciously put before you to do some of his finest work. For here in our text, it's a prison for Paul. It's a prison for Paul. And yet he is not constrained by his chains from proclaiming Christ. Over in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 9, Paul says this. He says, I am suffering even to the point of being chained like a criminal, but God's word is not chained. Friends, God's word is never chained by our circumstances. Paul's chains actually freed him up to do some things that he wouldn't otherwise have been able to do. Let me give you three things that happened for Paul. Do this very quickly. Three things that Paul's chains opened up for him, gave him the freedom to do. First of all, Paul's chains gave him the freedom to preach the gospel to the soldiers, the Roman soldiers. Now, how would Paul have audience with the soldiers unless they were guarding him? Verse 13, chapter 1. As a result, it has become clear throughout the whole palace guard and to everyone else that I am in chains for Christ. I want you to get this picture in your mind. Think about Paul in jail in Rome. He's handcuffed to Roman soldiers 24 hours a day. There's a shift change every 6 hours. Imagine the poor slob that is assigned to guard him, to be chained to Paul. This guy, this guard, is chained to a man who prays without ceasing. Oh, when is he going to quit praying? He's chained to a guy who rejoices without, you know, he rejoices continually, always. He's always happy. He's always full of the joy of the Lord. He's chained to a guy that gives thanks in everything. Can you imagine the soldiers going, get me out of here. I'm about to go AWOL from this guy. He's chained to a guy that is continually dictating letters to his copyist. He doesn't write the letters himself, which is great because now the soldiers have to listen to him dictate the gospel, these prison epistles. I mean, these poor guys are Paul's not the captive audience. These soldiers are. And it wasn't too long before some of them, these elite Praetorian guards, soldiers, put their faith in Jesus Christ. Paul wouldn't have been free to do that without his chains. That's one. Two, Paul's chains freed him to preach the gospel in Caesar's court. Go over to chapter 4, look at verse 22. As Paul's giving his concluding remarks and saying thank you to this person, thank you to that person, he says this, all of God's people send you greetings, especially those who belong to Caesar's household. People in the house of Caesar, the family of Caesar, came to know Christ. Know who Caesar was at the time? Nero, bad dude. And some of his own family came to know Jesus because of Paul. So Paul's was a landmark case before the Roman emperor and before the Roman Senate legal system. And the landmark case was this. He was brought there to determine whether this new sect, Christianity, was subversive to Roman law and dangerous to the Roman Empire. It was a very, very big deal. Paul was licking his chops at the prospect of defending his Christian doctrine before this august body. He would be able to proclaim, whether they received it or not, he would be able to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ in defending himself. So this was an opening for Paul, not an obstacle. An opening, not an obstacle. And then number three, his chains actually freed him to embolden the other believers in Rome. Back to chapter 1, verse 14. Because of my chains, most of the believers have become confident in the Lord and dare all the more to proclaim the gospel without fear. The Roman Christians were strengthened when they saw the faith and the courage and the boldness and the determination of the Apostle Paul. Do you know that pessimism and fear is contagious? I mean, you've witnessed that in life, in your family, in your organization. I mean, it can just sweep through a place and just take over. But so can courage. Boldness is contagious. The word proclaim that is used here in that verse isn't the usual word for preach. The word that is used actually refers to just everyday conversations. It's not referring to someone standing up like I am and proclaiming to you. It's talking about you just talking with one another. Everyday conversations. You see, Rome was fixated on legal matters. You know, just kind of like Washington, D.C. today is fixated on stupid stuff. You know, legal stuff, you know, matters that are, you know, swirling around the city. The Apostle Paul's case was swirling around Rome and in the minds of Romans, much like people in Washington, D.C. and New York City are talking all the time about the Robert Mueller investigation. I mean, that's how much it was consuming these people. And as the believers saw Paul's boldness, they were inspired and they began taking advantage of water cooler conversations, as it were, to put a good word in for God. We can do that too. As people are talking about stuff, they just inserted themselves and gave a good word for Jesus. Paul took advantage of his disadvantage to proclaim Christ. So can you. I bet you've got chains in your life. Maybe not as dramatic as Paul. Maybe it's not as hard as what Paul was going through. But let me ask you this. This is kind of where we come to in this moment. Is there any reason why you can't allow God to use your chains for his glory? Is there any reason? And the answer is no. So I want to challenge you in these final moments that we have together, and as you take this message out and think about it, meditate on it, pray about it the rest of the day, I want to challenge you to repurpose your obstacles into opportunities. Whatever your obstacle is, it's an opportunity. Redefine it. It's an opportunity to glorify God. Use your detour. See your detours as a doorway to impact for the glory of God. Now, how are you going to do that? I'm going to invite Christelle to come back to the platform. We'll pray and sing in a moment here. But how do you do that? I'm going to give you three simple ways. Here's where it starts. Right now, even right now, identify the chains that are in your life. Maybe it's one, maybe it's a bunch of chains. And I would just encourage you to record them, write them down. You're probably thinking, I hope you are, you're probably thinking about them right now. You know, what is it? So on your sermon notes, which some of you are filling out, some of you don't even know what I'm talking about. It's in your bulletin. It's in your program. Just take it out and write it down. This is my chain. These are my chains. Physical limitations, financial challenges, a difficult marriage, the grief, the loss that you feel over singleness, if you do, a hostile work environment, difficulty with friends, rejection, whatever it is, just write it down. Just write it down. That's the first step. You got to identify it. And then, once you've written it down, once you've identified it, thank God for it. Thank God for each one of those. God, thank you for this. Remember, you're repurposing those obstacles into opportunities. God, thank you for this opportunity. There's a Scottish hymn writer by the name of George Matheson, a theologian, and he wrote out a prayer that I think I've shared before, but this is absolutely a profound, powerful prayer. I want to read it to you. Matheson prayed, "My God, I have never thanked thee for the thorns in my life, but I have thanked thee 1,000 times for my roses, but not once for my thorns. I've been looking forward to a world where I shall get compensation for my cross, but I have never thought of my cross as itself a present glory. Teach me the glory of my cross. Teach me the value of my thorns. Show me that I have climbed to thee by the path of pain. Show me that my tears have made my rainbow." Boy, that is a deep water prayer, isn't it? That is profound. And is there any reason why you and I shouldn't pray that prayer too? God, thank you for these chains. Thank you for these thorns. Maybe you're saying, well, man, I'm not George Matheson. There's no way. You know, I couldn't do that. You don't know what I'm going through. Hey, guess what? George Matheson went totally blind when he was 20 years old. And he wrote these kind of prayers and hymns and theology anyway. I mean, you haven't experienced anything like that. So you can repurpose your prayers into gratitude, prayers of gratitude. Even if you have gone through difficult things, still do that. It's an act of faith that unleashes your chains and turns them into opportunities to glorify God. And then finally, I'll close with this. Take advantage of your disadvantage Take advantage of your disadvantage by using it to talk about Jesus this week. Insert Jesus. Insert Jesus into your disadvantage and it will become an advantage for you. You know, I have two older brothers. Ken is the oldest, Bill is the second oldest brother, and he's 4 years older than me. And Bill was, God bless him, was born with the most pessimistic personality, I think, on the face of the planet. He just was negative. He saw the dark side of life, and he was just kind of a buzzkill, honestly. And he's hard to be around. And in his adult life, he got diabetes, very severe diabetes, and it just has debilitated his life. I mean, for decades now, his kidneys are shot. He's mostly blind. He can't walk. He's got neuropathy in his legs. The medication he takes has caused him to swell. He's huge. He's in a wheelchair. He lives in an assisted living home, an adult home. He can't take care of himself. But something happened in Bill's life now 3 or 4 years ago, a radical transformation. And he now is the most optimistic, joyful person I've ever met, and an absolute pleasure to be around. We're talking on the phone. I said, dude, what has happened to you? And he goes, I only got so much time left. He knows he's not long for this world. He says, I'm going to use every opportunity to rejoice in the Lord and to tell other people about Jesus. And everywhere the guy goes, he's got a finger in people's chest, so to speak, and he's telling them about Jesus. We were at the memorial service this past Thursday for my little sister who passed away suddenly. And so I had, you know, the family sharing some things, and it came to my brother Bill, and he said, our sister Teresa knew Jesus, and I know she's in heaven. And he said, I'm going to be there too. But some of you don't know Jesus, and you better get right with the Lord. I mean, he's using every opportunity to talk about the Lord. It's just the most amazing, radical change I've ever seen. He's using his disadvantage as an advantage to talk about Jesus. What are your chains? What are your chains? Like Bill, is it an incurable disease? Your joy in the midst of that suffering will give you the hope, will give the hope of eternity to another sufferer as they see it in you. Is it a financial crisis? Your joy will teach your kids how to trust God in difficult times. Is it a divorce? Your joy will show others how to forgive like Jesus. Are you in life's waiting room? Your joy will inspire others to stay faithful when their life has been put on hold. You got chains? You got chains? This is your finest hour. It's your finest hour. Back in World War II, in 1940, the German army, the Nazis, were overrunning Europe, devastating, laying waste in the most horrific fashion. The only army capable of standing against them at the time was the British army. And Great Britain was just being hammered. The land was being laid waste. They were on the verge of collapse when Winston Churchill stood before the House of Commons and he gave one of the most memorable, rousing speeches ever. And this is how he ended that speech. He said, let us therefore brace ourselves to our duties and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, people will still say, this was their finest hour. Got chains? This is your finest hour. Hallelujah.
Thanks again for listening to this week's edition of the Portland Christian Center podcast. If you want more information about the ministries of Portland Christian Center or have a prayer need, please visit us online at pcctoday.com. Thanks for listening.